This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Alhamdulillah, Rabbil Alameen, wassalatu wassalamu ala Nabiyyil Kareem wa ala alihi wa ashabi ajma'in. I'd like to welcome you all to today's session, where we will continue with week 2 in our Qawaid al-Fiqhiyah, the legal fiqh maxims. So what you're going to do today is very briefly, I'm going to recap last week's discussion on what are the Qawaid al-Fiqhiyah and what is the first of these Qaidas. And after that, we will discuss today's session, which is all about the second of the Qawaid, which is Al-Yaqeenu La Yadulu Bishak, conviction is not removed by doubt. So this is going to be the topic today. It looks like a very technical thing, but this is a very important principle that will solve a lot of issues in our community. Many, many issues in our community in terms of fiqh and in terms of myths that are prevalent in the community. This principle can solve most of it. So don't underestimate the importance of this principle in fiqh. So to begin, when we talk about al-qawaid al-fiqhiyah, what are we referring to? We said that in the later generations of fiqh scholarship, so we're looking at around the 6th century of Islam onward, the ulama started inventing formula to make fiqh easier, right? To make ijtihad easier. So they began to write books on fiqh, which were written from a formula perspective. So what this meant is, instead of ulama having to memorize entire books of fiqh, they just memorized a few formulas and they used that for solving fiqh issues. And these became known as the Qawaid al-Fiqhiyah, the fiqh maxims, which are simple formula that are used for solving thousands of fiqh issues. Literally every small statement that we will study over the next 5 weeks, each of these small statements can be used to solve 1,000 issues or more. They are that powerful when it comes to fiqh. We also learned last week that the 5 major maxims are agreed upon by the 4 madhabs. So whatever we're teaching is something upon which there is ijma, consensus between the madhabs, that these are the 5 main maxims of fiqh. But they differ in how to apply the maxims and some of the subsidiary maxims, some of the maxims that branch out from it. Right? But the 5 main maxims, which is going to be our primary focus, that's agreed upon by the 4 madhabs. Before I go any further, can anyone tell me what are these 5 maxims? At least one or two of them. Intentions, that's what we covered last week. Okay, this week we're covering conviction and doubt. Someone give me an idea, another one? Harm must be eliminated. Good. Two more? Difficulty causes the law to relax. Difficulty causes ease. Right? Difficulty causes the law to relax. And the final one? Yes. Local culture is the deciding factor. Meaning, whenever there is a clash of cultures and all options are halal, you go with the local culture. Right? So, to recap, we said that fiqh is, to make it easy to understand, the ulama have invented this concept of fiqh maxims. And all 4 madhabs agreed upon these 5 maxims. That intentions are what matter most. Conviction cannot be removed by doubt. Difficulty causes the law to relax. Harm must be eliminated. And local culture is a deciding factor. These 5 maxims, called al-qawaid al-fiqhi al-kubra, the 5 major maxims of fiqh, they are agreed upon by the madhabs. They may just disagree in how they are applied. Last week we looked very briefly at the first maxim, that actions are judged by the intentions. And what we said from this is that in every area of fiqh, you will use this maxim. In every area of fiqh, you will find laws that are based on intention. For example, when it comes to salah, intention matters. When it comes to differentiating between zakah and sadaqah, intention matters. When it comes to differentiating between bribery and gifting, intention matters. When it comes to making seeing the difference between murder and manslaughter, between premeditated murder and manslaughter, the difference is intention. Right? So, in almost every area of fiqh, intentions are the first thing that is looked at before the actual ruling is decided. So today we're going to cover the second of the maxims of fiqh, which is Al-Yaqeenu La Yadulu Bishak, conviction is not overruled by doubt. And historically, this is the first known maxim to be coined. Right? This is the first known maxim to be coined. The very first book on Qawaid al-Fiqhiyah by Al-Kharqi al-Hanafi. So the first book on Qawaid al-Fiqhiyah was written by a Hanafi scholar. Right? The very first maxim that he mentions in this book is the same maxim. Not with the same wording. Because what happened is, when the maxims were first invented, they were much longer and wordier. And over time, the scholars shortened it, until they got a simple 3 or 4 word sentence that could be memorized. So he had a much longer statement like, the original ruling related to anything is that certainty cannot be overcome by any kind of doubt, or something like that. Right? Very long-winded way of saying, al-yaqinu la yadudu bishak. But nonetheless, the first book on al-qawaid al-fiqhiyah ever written, the very first qaida mentioned in that book, is this one. So we can say that this is the first thing that the ulama noticed in terms of qawaid. And by the way, the way qawaid was formulated is, the ulama looked for common patterns in fiqh. This is what they looked for. They looked for common patterns in fiqh. So for example, they looked at every area of fiqh and they realized that in every area of fiqh, intentions matter. So that became a qaida. Similarly, they looked at every area of fiqh and they realized that certain things are established by yaqeen, other things are doubtful, and so this principle was established based on that. So this was one of the very first qaidas to be established in fiqh. In the very first book of Qaid al-Fiqhiyah, this is the first qaida mentioned in that book. Right. This qaida, there are many Quranic verses and hadiths that are taken as evidence for this. The most clear hadith that's used as evidence for this is the hadith where the Sahaba asked the Prophet ﷺ about when you are praying salah and you are doubtful whether your wudu is broken or not. What did the Prophet ﷺ say? He said, unless you smelt it or heard it, continue with your salah. Meaning, unless you have conviction that you broke your wudu, you go with what you have conviction of, which is that you have wudu. So that's considered the primary evidence for this principle. Linked to that is another hadith, that if you have forgotten whether you are in the third or second rakah, you treat it as the second rakah. Right? Because you're convinced that you prayed one rakah, you're doubtful whether you prayed the second rakah. So you go with what you're convinced about. And there are many verses in the Quran where Allah talks about yaqeen, and where He talks about don't follow doubt, don't follow shak. All of these verses are considered as evidence for this. In usul al-fiqh, this is called istishab. So in usul al-fiqh, this principle is called istishab. In qaid al-fiqhiyah, it's called al-yaqinu la yadudu bishak. Istishab means linking something back to its original state or ruling until a change is confirmed. So istishab means, for example, and we'll cover a lot of this in a later slide, things are halal until proven haram. People are innocent until proven guilty. Water is pure until proven impure. And so on and so forth. Everything has an original state in the Sharia. It stays in that state until proven otherwise. Right? So this is called istishab. And technically all the mazhabs have it. They may just have different names for it. It applies to almost every area of fiqh. Has practical everyday usages. To such an extent that Jalaluddin As-Suyuti rahimahullah stated that this maxim is used in 3/4 of fiqh issues. 3/4 of fiqh issues, right? Imam As-Suyuti stated that 3/4 of fiqh issues, so we're looking at hundreds of thousands of issues, are solved with this one maxim. So for now, you may not be able to understand why, but as you go through the subsidiary maxims and the examples, it becomes clearer. So this is not a small maxim, this is a major principle of fiqh that is used to potentially solve hundreds of thousands of issues. And that's why As-Suyuti said 3/4 of fiqh is solved by this. When it comes to the issue of intentions, As-Shafi'i said 2/3 of fiqh are related to intentions. When it comes to conviction and doubt, As-Suyuti said 3/4 of fiqh are related to this. Now, these are not exact numbers. These are exaggerations. Right? Obviously, one can't be 2/3, the other can't be 3/4. It doesn't add up. But rather, it's exaggerations put there simply to show that a large percentage is solved using this. So what do we mean by certainty cannot be overruled by doubt? To put it very simply, in many fiqh issues, there is something that you are certain about and there is something that you are doubtful about. When you are certain about something and doubtful about something else, the fiqh ruling is on what you are certain about. Let's look at the examples to make this clear. So the most obvious example If you are certain that you are in a state of purity and you are doubtful about breaking it, you are considered pure. The reverse is also true. If you are certain about being impure and doubtful about purification, you remain impure. So for example of the first one, you remember performing wudu. You don't remember whether you broke the wudu or not. So you remain in a state of wudu. Example of the second one, you remember going to the toilet, but you can't remember if you made wudu after that or not. So you're considered impure. Why? In both cases, you go with what you are certain about. In one case, you are certain that you made wudu, so that's what you go with. In the other case, you are certain that you went to the toilet, so that's what you go with. So whenever there's a clash, am I in the state of wudu, am I not in the state of wudu, you rule on what are you certain about. I am certain that I made wudu, or am I certain that I went to the toilet? Right? You look at what you are certain about, that becomes the ruling. Similarly, in salah, when you are doubtful as to whether you are in the second or third rak'ah, then you treat it as the second rak'ah. Why? If you are doubtful whether you are in the second or third rak'ah, that means you are convinced that you prayed the first rak'ah. But you can't remember whether you prayed the second rak'ah. So you go with what you are convinced about and you treat this as the second rak'ah. If someone doubts whether the sun has set yet, he shouldn't break the fast. Okay, I think in South Africa we take this one a bit to an extreme, right? Because sometimes the sun has set and then someone's about to open their fast and they're like, wait, 5 seconds left until the time on the calendar. Meanwhile, the time on the calendar is set 5 minutes late as a precaution. I don't know how many of y'all know that. Our South African calendars are technically set 5 minutes late as a precaution.
You shouldn't
have known that. I break on time because the hadith says you must hasten.
They
break their fast before the azan. They do. Yes. The hadith says you're supposed to hasten to break the fast. Now, if you are doubtful, so for example, it's a cloudy day. It's a time, we're living in an age where there's no watches and clocks and calculations like we have today. That's when this principle would have applied more. You're out camping in the forest, whatever it is. It's cloudy, it's raining. You don't know if the sun has set yet. So you wait until you are sure. It gets dark, now you are sure. Nowadays this wouldn't really apply because we use calculations, right, to work out sunrise and sunset. But again, as I mentioned, in South Africa, our calendar for both when suhoor ends and when iftar sets in, about 5 minutes off, between 3 to 5 minutes off. If you actually check the timings on websites that work with calculations, you'll see that suhoor actually ends 5 minutes later. Right, so they're robbing us of 5 minutes of chow time. And iftar is the opposite, that it actually, iftar sets in about 5 minutes earlier. Right, so this becomes a big clash. I remember last Ramadan I was having iftar with someone and time set in and I'm opening my fast and he's sitting there and looking at my face and ask him why. He said because he's going with the African calendar. So I opened my fast 5 minutes before him. So this is again something that we might not be aware of. But what happened is in the Hanafi Mazhab we have this concept of taking precautions, being safe rather than sorry, right? And so to be safe rather than sorry, they set the suhoor time 5 minutes early so people don't mistakenly eat past the time, and they set the iftar time about 3 or 4 minutes later so people don't mistakenly open their fast too early. Now people have taken those as absolute times, and that's where the problem comes in, because technically those are not the actual times, right? What we are taking as the actual times are not the actual times. Moving on to the next example. If someone doubts whether it is suhoor, yet he can continue eating until he is convinced. Right? If you're not sure whether suhoor time has ended yet, so you're having your suhoor, your sehri, and you're not sure whether time's up yet or not. So you are convinced that it was suhoor time, you are doubtful whether it's over yet. You actually can keep eating until you are sure that suhoor time has ended. So here, it's the opposite of what we do in South Africa. Right? Many of us stop eating, firstly our calendars are set 5 minutes too early. Many of us stop eating 10 or 15 minutes before that time because we're scared of going over. Right? In reality, the Sahaba would eat right until the azan. They would eat right until the azan, right until they are convinced that, okay, time's up now. If someone doubts how many rounds of tawaf one has made, you go with the smaller number. Again, all of this is, you're convinced about one thing, you are doubtful about something else. So you're going around the Kaaba making tawaf, and suddenly you remember, am I in the fourth or fifth round? So you treat it as which round? Fourth. Why? Because you definitely show you went around the Kaaba three times. You can't remember whether you went around it the fourth time. So you treat it as a smaller number. So you always go with that which you are convinced about. You remember borrowing money from someone. You can't remember whether you paid them back. These are in the books of fiqh, right? Maybe in the olden days it was a bit more harder to keep track of these things. Who forgets this these days? I don't know. But this is in the books of fiqh as an example of it. Right? You borrow money from someone, you can't remember whether you paid them back, and they're saying you never paid them back, or whatever the case may be, they can't remember themselves. Then you treat it as you still have to pay them back. Why? You are convinced that you borrowed money, you are not convinced that you paid it back. Right? Yaqeen over shak. The opposite is also true, right? You remember paying somebody back, right? And that person is arguing about it, then it's considered as paid back if there's some evidence for that. In Islam, you're supposed to keep evidence of everything when it comes to business transactions. There should be documented evidence of every business transaction, because you never know when somebody takes you to court and says, you know, you owe me money, you never pay me back, or something like that. So in our religion, you're supposed to keep documented evidence or witnesses or signed contracts or whatever it is, some evidence that the transaction took place. The longest verse in the Quran is about this. The longest verse in the entire Quran is about getting witnesses and signing and letting people know, you know, that you have evidence that a deal took place between two people, so that there's no disputes amongst Muslims. Right? Nowadays, you know, we have the idea of just going on my word for it. Too many times that's come back to hurt a person. So let's just be a bit more aware of that. Make sure. Nowadays, most of our stuff are done on the computers anyway. What I like to do is, any EFT I do, I always make sure I have the bank send me a proof of payment, and send them a proof of payment as well. So they say they never get the payment, or they never get the proof of payment, I still have my copy. Right? So this is, again, an important part of our religion that many people are unaware of. Making sure that you have recorded evidence for every business transaction. Then you never fall into this case of doubt, inshallah. Whatever is testified by evidence or the required number of witnesses is regarded as yaqeen. Okay, so in our fiqh of hudud, in our fiqh of criminal law, we have very strict application of this principle. We will never apply a had punishment unless there is yaqeen. Right? This is our law. We will never apply a had punishment unless there is yaqeen. This is why some of the ulama have stated there actually has never been in the history of Islam an actual stoning of an adulterer based on witnesses. It's only ever been based on confession. Right? Because we have set the bar so high that even if there is the slightest doubt, we will not carry out the punishment. So if there is the slightest doubt whether somebody stole or not, or whether they had the excuse for stealing or not, the judge will not chop off his hand. If there is the slightest doubt whether zina took place or not, the had punishment will not take place. If there is the slightest doubt whether actual murder took place or not, the had punishment will not take place. The Sharia is very strict on this. Unless it is established by yaqeen, we will not carry out the had punishment. Yes, the judge could put a smaller punishment. So for example, if the husband is accusing his wife of zina or vice versa, and there's no evidence and nobody wants to go through with the whole li'an process, then the judge could break up the marriage, right? As a way of making sure that, you know, something that happens. Or if somebody stole and there's not enough evidence to chop off his hand, the judge could put him in jail for a few days, or send him for some kind of reform classes, or make him pay back the amount that he stole. So there is a lesser punishment that come in. But the had punishment, these punishments that Islam is often criticized for, these are never applied unless there is yaqeen. And yaqeen can only be established by three ways. Clear evidence, and that too, nowadays evidence is something very doubtful nowadays, because people can doctor footage, people can make up videos, people can tamper with photographs. So evidence is very, very difficult to establish with yaqeen. Number two is witnesses. So the witness bar is very high. For some crimes it's two witnesses, for some it's four. And actually they have to witness the actual thing. And number three is confession. That's really the only time you actually find these punishments really being carried out. In the time of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, the only actual stonings of an adulterer or adulteress that we know of by the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam were in cases of confession. And that too, the Prophet ﷺ tried to make any possible excuse not to do it. He said, maybe you are insane, maybe you must remember, maybe you did this instead. You know, but the person said, no, I committed a sin, I want to be stoned. That's literally the only time it ever happened. Because otherwise our conditions are so strict, it's just not going to happen. So a hard punishment will not be carried out unless there is yaqeen. Unless the person himself is saying, this is what I did, they are confessing to the crime. That's A. Or B, there is clear evidence that they committed the crime. Or number three, there is witnesses, clear witnesses that they committed the crime. Okay, the last one is to do with witnessing. So, if you know something but you're unsure about something else, as a witness, you can only testify to that which you are sure about. So, for example, you are a witness that somebody borrowed money from someone else, but you don't know whether they paid him back or not. So if the court had to ask you, did this person borrow money from that person, you have to say yes. And if they ask you, did they pay them back, you have to say, I don't know. You have to go with what you convinced. And you cannot just make things up because you like this guy or you feel sorry for him or because there is some idea maybe he paid him back. Remember, our Sharia never works on maybes. And we're going to come to this in the next slide when we look at these subsidiary maxims. Our Sharia does not work on maybes. You go with what you're convinced about. So when you are called upon to testify, you only testify to that which you are sure about. Anything else you say, I don't know. I'm not sure. I don't have evidence. Right? So that way, you do not end up unintentionally speaking a lie. Now, Sharia has very strict punishments for people doing things like this, you know, like false testimony in court. There's something that also has a very strict punishment in our Sharia. So these are the examples mentioned in the books of fiqh. So you'll find these examples in the early books of Hanafi fiqh and Shafi fiqh, Maliki fiqh, Hanbali fiqh. All of them mention the same examples. These are actually issues where there's ijma. Every mazhab is going to give you the same answer. Whether you ask a Shafi or Hanafi or Maliki Imam, they're all going to give you the same answer on these issues, because this principle is agreed upon by all the mazhabs, and its application in these issues is agreed upon by all the mazhabs as well. And this is something a lot of people don't realize about fiqh. The vast majority of fiqh is actually agreed upon by the mazhabs. It's just very small portion where there's difference of opinion. It's just that those small portion is what's visible in our society. I mean, if you think about it, all the mazhabs agree that there's five salah, that you fast the month of Ramadan, when is suhoor, when is iftar, what's the percentage of zakat, how you perform hajj. All the mazhabs agree on these things. It's the minor things, whether your hands are here or here, whether you raise your hand before and after ruku. These are the minor issues where they have differences of opinion. Okay, so what we're going to do now is we're going to look at these subsidiary maxims. Now, what does this mean? What this means is, in fiqh, every one of the five main maxims have other maxims that branch out from them. Right? For more technical or more detailed issues. So each maxim has other maxims linked to it. So if you look at the maxim that actions are judged by the intention, one of the maxims that stem out from there is that there is no reward without a good intention. That's a subsidiary maxim of it. Right? There is no reward without a good intention. Meaning if you did a good deed with a wrong intention, there's no reward for it. So what we're going to look at are the subsidiary maxims linked to al-yaqeenu la yadudu bishak. And most of these are actually the maxims of istishab. So in Arabic, most of these maxims begin with the words al-asl. Al-asl means the original state or the original ruling. So almost all these maxims show us the original ruling of something, and that becomes part of istishab or al-yaqeenu la yadudu bishak. So the most general one is that the original rule of anything is that it remains as it originally was. What does this mean? It means, for example, water. What is the original state of water? Pure. So any water that you find is pure unless proven to be impure. How do you prove water to be impure? There's three things mentioned in Hanafi fiqh, right?
No.
The smell, the taste, or the color changes. Right? So if the water smells like najasa or tastes like najasa or has the color of najasa, then only it's impure. If none of these three are there, no matter how much doubt you have about it, the water remains pure. Right? You do not rule on doubt, you rule upon what it originally was. So the original state of water is purity. The original state of a belief. This is an interesting one. The original state of a belief is that it is non-existent. Meaning, if someone says that angels don't enter a hall in which there are men without beards, do you believe that or not? You don't believe that. Right? I just made a random example, right? Because someone told me something similar, right? Recently someone told me, angels won't enter a woman's kitchen unless she's wearing hijab. How do you get that? Where do you get that from? Right? So it's actually the principle of our religion. The original ruling regarding any belief is that it's a superstition unless proven from the Quran and Sunnah. So if someone tells you, this is the belief, or this is what Islam teaches, the evidence must be upon them. They must show you a verse from the Quran or a hadith from the Prophet ﷺ proving that belief. Otherwise, that belief is not part of Islam. Right? This is how we get rid of superstition and myths, by applying this principle. Anything that is not proven to Quran and Sunnah is not a belief that is part of Islam. There are more of this, but they also mention a separate maxim, so I'll come to those separately. Starting with this one. Right? The original ruling or state of human beings is freedom from responsibility, or as it's worded nowadays in the West, people are innocent until proven guilty. Right? So, the original ruling regarding any human being in Islam is that they are innocent until proven otherwise. If someone is accused of stealing, of zina, of murder, of any crime, our Sharia says they are innocent until proven otherwise. And don't want to be controversial, but I have to. This is the problem with the Me Too movement. Right? You're familiar with the Me Too movement? Right? What's the problem with that? Believe all women. If a woman says a man did something wrong to her, you have to believe her. And there have been in the past 2 years, maybe hundreds of false cases. Where, I mean, at least a couple of sports stars I know of, I've been following their stories. A woman accused him, hashtag Me Too, he gets fired, he loses his fans, loses his job. 3 months later, the woman says, I was lying. Right? Man's entire career is ruined by a lie. So we get very emotional about these things. And we get very emotional and say, you have to believe them. Our Sharia actually is the opposite. Our Sharia is people are innocent until proven guilty. Because if we open this door of believing anyone, this is actually what happened to one of these people, was that he was in his hotel room, one of these sports players, he was in his hotel room, and a female fan came to him and wanted to sleep with him. And he said no. And she said, if you don't sleep with me, I'll tell people you raped me. And he said no. And so the next day she posted on Twitter that he raped her. And he got fired, and he lost his job. So these things are happening. So the idea that believe all women or believe all men, either way it's wrong. In Islam, people are innocent until proven guilty. There has to be evidence. Now, the emotional issue that pops up here is that if you have to have evidence for every crime, a lot of people are going to get away with crimes. That's the emotional aspect of it. That people are getting away with sexual abuse, with rape. And as Muslims, we don't believe they get away with it. Why? Why don't we believe they get away with it? We have the Day of Judgment. This is something we firmly believe as Muslims. You see, the people behind this movement don't believe in the Day of Judgment. They believe there's no punishment in this world and the person got away with it. We don't believe that. We believe that a crime, if it's punished in this world, the person won't be punished for it in the afterlife. Right? First, that's the first thing. Right? Secondly, if they got away with it, they will be punished in the afterlife. And the punishment in the afterlife is more severe. Right? So they're not getting away with it. If a man, na'udhu billah, did something immoral to a woman, right, against her will, and there is no witnesses, and there is no way for her to prove it, we believe as Muslims that on the Day of Judgment he is in big trouble. There is no way he is getting away with it. So, therefore we don't need these movements, because our faith is not in the justice system of this world, our faith is in the justice of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And we also believe, and this is something I personally believe from experience, that anyone who constantly commits a crime will get caught in this world. And Ali radiallahu anhu stated this as well. Ali radiallahu anhu said, You know, when you catch a thief and chop off his hand, it wasn't the first time he stole. Right? It wasn't the first time he stole. Because the first time somebody steals, what did Allah do? Allah forgives them and hides their sin. Second time, Allah forgives them and hides their sin. Now once it becomes a habit, once they become criminals, once they become, you know, people who are hardened to this crime, that is when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala exposes them. It's the same thing with sexual predators. It's the same thing with men who abuse women. Right? They did it once, maybe Allah will leave it for the Day of Judgment. They're doing it often, Allah will expose them in some way or another in this world. Allah will make sure that they're exposed in this world. Why? To protect people from them. So these are things that we believe about this. And so therefore, we must be careful not to get emotional about these issues. It is an emotional issue. But when one of the principles of the Sharia is, when dealing with fiqh and when dealing with court cases, you cannot involve emotion. You cannot deal with a court case based on emotion. You have to look at facts. So in these issues, we do not go with the hashtag, we don't go with the movement, we don't go with what feminism is saying, we don't go with, but what if she's telling the truth? Rather we say, if she's telling the truth, either Allah will expose him in this world, or he's going to get it big trouble on the Day of Judgment. Right? And if they are witnesses or something, alhamdulillah, then Allah will open the door. But at the end of the day, we can't just open the door of just believing everyone on everything, because not everybody is honest, and there have been so many cases of the opposite happening, right? Where people purposely lied just to get someone fired, or to get someone in trouble, or to get someone, you know, to lose their job, or just out of spite, sometimes just out of spite. If a woman knows that a man that she wants to marry is married to someone else, to break up the marriage, she could lie. Or even the opposite way around, right? So, therefore, people are innocent until proven guilty. This is one of the principles of the Sharia. Be very careful with WhatsApp messages like this. Again, every few months there's a WhatsApp message going around. It's always somebody new, it's always a new drama. This person is doing this, this person is doing that, this person involved in these sins. Innocent until proven guilty. Right? If whatever we hear, there's a verse in the Quran, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, why that the believers, when they hear such rumors, they should think good about themselves. Interesting, you're not saying think good about the others, he says you must think good about yourself. Meaning you must say, I wouldn't do it, so I doubt they would do it. Right? So, thinking good about yourselves and the other person, people are innocent until proven guilty. And we leave these things for the Day of Judgment. We don't have to be obsessed with justice in this world. What is confirmed by certainty can only be invalidated by certainty. So this just reinforces the primary principle. Right? The primary principle is, certainty is not overruled by doubt. So just to reinforce that, or to clarify, what is certainty overruled by? It's overruled by a new certainty. Right? So someone, right, how this would work is, someone remembers making wudu. They're doubtful whether they broke their wudu or not. So they are considered in a state of wudu. But as they're about to start their salah, they get the flashback and say, oh, now I remember. I broke my wudu. So now it's also certain. So now certainty will overcome certainty, and this now makes it that you'll go with the new information. Right? Similarly, in a court case, that someone's innocent until proven guilty, what will prove them guilty? Certainty. Certainty here comes from what? Witnesses or clear evidence. Or confession. Right? Or confession. Next one. This one is not applied in South Africa at all. Right, the next subsidiary maxim of this, al aslu fil ashay al ibaha, the original state of anything is permissibility. Right, the original state of anything when it comes to the dunya is permissibility. There is, for the most part, ijma on this concept. There are three positions. Okay, let's put it this way: the Shafi'is, Malikis, and Hanbalis all agree upon this maxim. There's only one mazhab that has a difference of opinion about this maxim. Which mazhab do you think that is? Hanafi mazhab. In the Hanafi mazhab, there are three positions. There are actually three different maxims here. Some Hanafis say the original rule of everything is haram until proven halal. Some Hanafis say,
that's
Majlis. That's some Hanafis say, I believe this was the position of Abu Hanifa, I could be mistaken here, is that things are doubtful until proven halal or haram. So he doesn't pass judgment. He just leaves it as doubtful until proven either way. But the majority of Hanafi ulama throughout history have gone with the majority of ulama throughout history. So actually, the mainstream Hanafi position throughout history, and this you find practiced amongst the Hanafis of Iraq, the Hanafis of Turkey, the Hanafis of the majority of the world besides Indian Hanafis for some reason, is that the original rule for anything is permissibility. So you can say that 90% of ulama agree upon this principle. There's a very small group that does not, and I really believe any ulama of the past who have the view that things are haram until proven halal, I think they would have changed the opinion nowadays. Because if you had to apply the principle today, right, if you had to actually apply the principle today, how do we prove a projector is halal? How do you prove a laptop is halal? How do you prove internet is halal? You can't. You can't prove any of these things are halal. Right? So that principle becomes very impractical in the modern world. So therefore, it is my view that nowadays all of the ulama should go with the majority view. And the majority view, even in the Hanafi madhab, is that al-aslu fil ashay al-ibaha, the original rule for any worldly thing is permissibility. What this means is that anything you see, you have yaqeen that it is halal, and if you have shak about it being doubtful, or if you have doubtful about it being haram, then it is permissible until proven otherwise. So for example, if someone tells you that internet is haram, you ask them what is your proof. If someone tells you that television is haram, you ask them what is your proof. Right? Anything. Things are halal until proven haram. If human beings invent a new thing, it is halal unless proven haram. Now how would you prove it haram? The principle we're going to discuss next week, that's how you prove it haram. What's the principle we're discussing next week? Adoro yuzal, harm must be eliminated. So how do you prove something is haram? You prove it to be harmful. If you have evidence that the harms of something outweigh its benefits, then you can say it's haram. Right? So this is why I'm of the view that smoking is haram. This is why I'm of the opinion that painkiller medication is haram except in necessity. This is why I'm of the opinion that recreational drugs are haram, right? Because all of these things have known harms. So even though they're not mentioned in Quran and Sunnah, the other principle that we're going to learn next week, Adoru Yudlal, that principle makes them haram. So we have a problem in South Africa that we are too quick to call things haram. We are way too quick to call things haram. And by the time we change our minds or change our opinion, the harm is already done from unnecessarily making things haram. I mean, just look at our history in the past 100 years, right? So when the radio was invented, ulama said it's haram. They said it's some kind of magic, right? Some kind of sihr. And they said it's haram. And as a result, we got Muslim radio stations way too late. When television was invented, Muslim said it was haram, and then 20 years later they started saying it's halal, and now we're getting Muslim television stations. You could have started that 20 years earlier, but we're behind everybody else because we started 20 years later. It goes further back in time, the Ottoman Empire, right? Also Hanafis, also same problems, right? They made the printing press haram, and they fell behind Europe because of that. And by the time they decide, oh, the printing press isn't actually haram, it's halal, they were way behind the rest of the world in terms of education. So this is a problem. And now, and nowadays, we have
microphone.
Yes, they say microphone is bidah. That's a funny in South Africa. Microphone is bidah, right? It just goes on and on and on. Anytime something new invented, the first thing we jump on is haram. I see. We need to scale back. It's halal until proven otherwise. Something new is invented, it is halal until proven otherwise. If you can prove that it is harmful, if you can prove that it is dangerous, if you can prove that it violates any of the maqasid of sharia, then we can say yes, it's halal. Otherwise, we say it's halal. In fact, to be completely honest with you, following the principles I follow, if I lived 100 years ago, I would have said smoking is halal. Why? Because 100 years ago, there was shak, there was doubt about smoking being harmful. But today I say it's haram because now we have yaqeen that smoking is harmful. Right? So again, something could be invented today. Let's give an example. something we all love, coffee. So coffee is halal. Someone say, but I think it might cause this problem. I think there might be some harms to it. As long as you think that there's harms to it, it remains halal, because conviction cannot be overcome by doubt. Now, 20, 30, 40 years time, one of our doctors here discover with conviction the harms of coffee. They do a full study. We find that 1 million people die from drinking coffee across the globe. Right? Now we will change our opinion. We say, okay, it's haram. Because now we have conviction that it's haram. Hopefully the time never comes. Right? Then it remains halal until the day of judgment. But that's how it works. So you work with the knowledge that's available in your time. And if an alim 100 years ago said that smoking is halal, his ruling was right for his time, because he based it on the knowledge that was available at his time. Right? So this is how it works. We have to be very careful with this principle. And now some people, they get worried. They say, oh, but if you say everything's halal until proven haram, you open the floodgates. You open the floodgates. People want to do everything. And my response is, so let him do everything. As long as it's not haram. We're going to stop someone from doing something halal. If you look at the ancient Muslim empires, nobody ever tried to stop someone from doing something halal. I mean, the only time I can think of is when the Ottoman Caliph banned coffee houses, not because it was haram, but because that's where people were plotting against him. Right? That's the only time I can remember that happening. But in general, the Sharia gives people full freedom to do anything halal, even if it is makruh. This is our principle. Even if it is makruh. Meaning, you see someone doing something makruh, you can't tell them don't do that. Why? It's not haram. It's not haram. Only if you're doing something that's clearly haram, then you can do nahiyanin munkar, preventing them from haram.
So they can eat their prawns.
They can eat their prawns. Yes, they can eat their prawns. The prawns issue is another one to come to. Because in the Hanafi Madhab, there are two opinions on prawns. Right? This is really where a lot of people forget about being Hanafis. A lot of people who are so strict on the taqlid just put the Hanafi madhab aside when it comes to seafood. But technically, if you go with Abu Hanifa's opinion, prawns would be haram. But nobody wants to hear that or say that anymore. Right? My opinion is halal, because of the Quran is very clear on that. But in general, if someone is doing something makruh, and this is why those ulama who believe that smoking is makruh, they will not stop anyone else from smoking. Right? Because in their view, it is makruh. And I'm the viewer, it's haram, so I tell people, don't smoke in front of me, don't smoke around me. Last time someone was smoking in front of me, I literally told him, in 40 years' time, if you have cancer or lung disease, don't blame me, because I want you. Nahi ani munkar. People need to realize the consequences of what they're doing. Otherwise, they don't see it. They don't know. So original rule is that things are halal. Again, the issue that it opens the floodgates, there's nothing wrong with opening the floodgates to halal. There is nothing wrong with it. Why are we trying to unnecessarily make Islam strict where Allah did not make it strict? So one of these issues that somebody raised recently on this is, someone told me, so you're saying dancing is halal. What do you guys say about that? Is dancing halal or haram? What's the context? That's a good one. Very good. But in general, in South Africa, if you give that answer, you get lynched. Right? The whole idea is dancing is haram. But let me ask you a question. Which verse of the Quran or Hadith says dancing is haram? Zero. There's literally not a single verse of the Quran or Hadith on that. Nothing at all. And traditionally, any Muslim culture in the world, if you've been to their weddings, separate for the men, separate for the woman, but in the woman's side of the wedding, what are they doing? They're dancing. That's from every single culture, every single madhab. Is that haram? Is it haram in a woman's only section, in a wedding, women are dancing with each other? Is it haram? It's not. It's not haram. Again, context. It's all about context, right? If a husband and wife are dancing in their bedroom, right, on the anniversary night, is it haram? They're going to do much worse things than dancing, all of that's halal. So how does the dancing become haram? Yeah.
Does it depend whether they're dancing with deaf music only?
So you get the this is the reason why people are scared of this principle, because a lot of things that we assume are haram, because we associate them with something else, technically they're not haram. So dancing, yes, if a woman is dancing in front of non-mahram men, it wouldn't be Islamically right, right? But if men are alone, or women are alone, or it's just mahrams, or it's just husband and wife, children dancing is their fitrah. Whether you teach them to dance or not, or tell them to dance or not, they're going to dance by their fitrah. It's just part of a child's nature to dance. They're not doing anything haram. So, the original rule for anything is permissibility. Moving in the opposite direction, not everything is permissible by nature. Three things are haram until proven halal. This is important. Three things are haram until proven halal. Number one, meat. Meat is haram until proven halal. Meaning, if you find a chicken tikka perfectly cooked, you have no idea where it came from, is it halal for you to eat it? No, because you don't know. You don't know. Is it halal? Was it slaughtered? Was it Muslim slaughtered? Did they say Bismillah? You don't know. Meat is actually haram until proven halal. And nowadays, technically, we can say a certificate from a halal body could count as proof of it being halal. We don't have to go to the extreme of some of our local movements. They want to know the name of the person who slaughtered it. Otherwise, they won't eat it. Right? We don't have to go to that extreme. But just knowing you're certified by Muslims is enough. But it's important to know that, because some people have gone in the opposite direction. No, everything's halal and it's proven haram. So you go to McDonald's in the USA, it's halal, because there's no proof that it's haram. It doesn't work like that. Meat is haram unless you have proof that it's halal. Now going to the whole Ahl Kitab thing, that's another story. Maybe in the Q&A we'll cover that. Right? The second thing that is haram until proven halal is acts of worship. Right? This is where the bid'ah thing comes. Now here there's a difference of opinion. The Shafi Mazhab will actually say it's halal until proven haram. The Hanbali Mazhab says it's haram until proven halal. Hanafi Mazhab at both positions. So basically, and this is the position I follow, is that the act of worship is bid'ah until proven to be sunnah. The act of worship is not part of our religion unless it can be proven to be part of our religion. Meaning, if somebody gets up and they pray 6 rakats extra salah after Isha, right, and they say this is part of our religion, you will say it is not part of our religion unless you can bring proof from Quran or Sunnah. And that applies to any act of worship. Now again, there is a difference of opinion here. So we have to be nuanced about the difference of opinion, and we have to tolerate the difference of opinion, because there are different positions in the different madhabs regarding the issue of what is bid'ah and what is not. So we have to be a bit more tolerant to this, because certain things, for example, reciting Quran as isale sawab for the dead, is permissible in the Hanafi madhab, but considered bid'ah in the Hanbali madhab. So you will find difference of opinion amongst the madhabs on whether a specific act is bid'ah or not. And again, it's one of the issues you get emotional about, but we have to understand there's difference of opinion. What's considered bid'ah to one person might not be bid'ah to someone else, because they're following different principles here. And because they are actually two opposing maxims here, based on two opposing groups of ulama. And both opinions are within Ahl Sunnah wal Jama'ah. The third thing that is prohibited until proven to be permissible is sexual relations of all kinds. So our Sharia has prohibited every kind of sexual relation besides two. Marriage and, Professor? You want to say that one? Two. Hmm?
I mean, sexual
right? Slave girls.
Yeah,
right. Completely blunt. Our religion allows only two types of sexual relations. One that applies to our time. Right? A marriage between a man and a woman, and a sexual relation between a man and a slave girl. The second one does not apply to our time. It does not. Right? A lot of men fantasize about it, but it does not. Right? A lot of women want to leave Islam because of it. But it's a fact. This is the fact. Some people, this is like the non-Muslims, one of the favorite things to attack Islam with. Your religion allows men to have sex with slave girls. My response is technically every religion does. technically, every single religion in the history of this world allowed a man to have sex with his slave girls. Which religion prohibited it? Hindus did it. Christians did it. It's in the Bible. Jews did it. So why is it an Islam thing? It's just that we live in a time where that doesn't exist. And I guarantee you, those same atheists who are so against it, if they lived in the time of slavery, they'd be the first ones to be doing it. Right? So it's just a matter of fact. That's something every religion allowed, including Islam. The only difference is Islam set very specific rules for it. And a slave girl who became pregnant through that relation, she had become a free woman when her husband died, and her status in society would be elevated. So for example, many people don't know this, that the Ottoman kings, most of them did not have wives. They literally had a harem of slave girls. And the next Ottoman king came from one of those slave girls. And she would be elevated to the status of Walid Sultana, Walida Sultana, mother of the king. And she would have the highest status in the kingdom after the king, despite being a slave girl. So again, this is part of our history, we need to know it. In our times, only one type of sexual relation that is allowed, that's between a man and his wife. So homosexuality is completely out. Not permitted at all, in any form. Again, there's some group trying to say, but between woman and woman, it's not so bad. It's still bad. It's still haram. I don't know why people say that it's not as bad. It's still haram. Right? It's exactly, because there's no sodomy involved, they assume it's not haram. It's still haram. Right? So the only type of relation that will be allowed in our time is between a man and his wife. But technically our Sharia allows two types, between a man and his wife and a man and his slave girl. Anything else is considered haram, and a man and a woman being together in our religion is considered haram unless it's proven, unless people know that they are married to each other. And this is why our Sharia tells us to make our marriages public, and this is why I'm completely against the idea of secret nikah, which by the way is very prevalent in our community. Secret nikahs are very prevalent in our community. And I believe it's completely haram, because people have to know. People have to know you're married. Otherwise they're going to assume you're committing zina, and it messes up everything from lineage to inheritance. Everything gets messed up when the secret nikah is involved. So that's another issue to go into. Anyway, we're running out of time. Let's finish this off. Imaginary things have no value. That's another subsidiary maxim. Imaginary things have no value. What does this mean? Someone says,
Cryptocurrency.
No, it doesn't apply to cryptocurrency. This cryptocurrency is a whole different issue to go into. But imaginary things over here means, for example, someone saying that the whole story, angels not entering a kitchen if a woman doesn't wear a scarf. That's an imaginary thing. And there's literally no evidence for that. It doesn't come anywhere in the Quran or Hadith. So imaginary things here refer to false beliefs, assumptions, assuming that there's some harm to something. So for example, if someone says, I think apples should be haram because I think it causes cancer. That's imaginary. That's someone's imagination. You cannot make fiqh rulings based on imagination. Right? So someone who has extreme OCD or some similar type of mental illness should not be in charge of fiqh. Because, a lot of imagination will end up dominating the fiqh rulings. Right? So imaginary things have no value in our Sharia. Unless you can prove something by evidence, it doesn't count at all. And what is normally unlikely is equivalent to the impossible. So anything that's highly unlikely, we don't consider it in our Sharia. Right? So people, a lot of times to make something haram, people say, but what if? So most common example in our community, you cannot let women go to the masjid because what if they commit zina in the masjid? Highly unlikely that anyone's committing zina in the masjid. Right? It's close to impossible. Close to impossible. Right? That it's like the most far-fetched idea in terms of what's possibly going to end up happening in the masjid. So you don't count it as all. You don't, anything that's highly unlikely, we don't count it at all when it comes to fiqh rulings. This is normally applied, for example, if a man disappeared 35 years ago, no one's seen from him, no one's heard from him. It's highly unlikely that he is alive, so he will be considered dead according to most of the mazhabs. Most of the mazhabs, because the Hanafi mazhab will go in the opposite direction. A lot of issues, all the mazhabs on one side, Hanafi mazhab goes in the opposite direction. By the way, on this issue, even though the Hanafi mazhab is in the opposite direction, in recent times, the Hanafi ulama, even those who are strict on blindly following their mazhab, do not follow the Hanafi mazhab on this issue. Why? Because with their modern technology, if someone disappeared for 35 years, they disappear, they're gone. Right? I mean, you can't get them with GPS, you can't get them with Google Earth, you can't get them with spies, you can't get them with a private investigator, you can't get them with any of our modern technology. They're probably dead in somewhere at the bottom of the ocean. Right? So, even the Hanafi mazhab, which gives, I think, something like 65 years before you can say his wife's a widow, even they have brought it less now and say, okay, nowadays it's not realistic to make someone wait that long. Right? So, there too, anything that's highly unlikely is considered impossible. For example, someone disappeared 35 years ago, it's highly unlikely that they're still alive. So, for in terms of inheritance and marriage, etc., they will be considered dead until proven alive. So, with that, we've reached the end. You can see the reason why we spent the entire hour on just one principle of fiqh is because there's so much to unpack. Just so much to unpack. Next week, we're going to cover two principles of fiqh. I'm going to cover two because we technically covered them already. One of them is harm must be eliminated. We covered that in Maqasid al-Sharia. The other is local culture is the deciding factor. We covered that in Usul al-Fiqh. Right? So I'll cover both of those from a Qawaid Fiqhiyah perspective next week. Look at the subsidiary maxims related to both. The week after that, we finish off this topic by looking at the final maxim. Again, very important for our time and our community. Difficulty causes relaxation in the law. We'll cover that. We'll do an entire hour on that, inshallah, in 2 weeks' time. That will be our final presentation on this topic. I think after that, I'm not sure if we're stopping for the holidays or not. We'll decide then, inshallah. I think in 2 weeks' time is school holidays, right? Okay, so Q&A. Any questions? Okay.
First one, I didn't want to jump in earlier, it'll be disruptive. Certainty of citing the moon versus calculation.
Okay, so excellent point. So, here's the issue, right? A lot of people want to stick with moon sighting with the naked eye. Even though technically, when it comes to determining the calendar for the rest of the year, are we dependent on moon sighting or calculations? Most of the world calculations. Our salah times, are we dependent on moon sight on the following the sun or calculations? Calculations.
To the second,
yes. Iftar and suhoor, are we looking at sunlight and sunset or are we looking at calculations? Calculations. So why do we have no problem following calculations on all those issues? But when it comes to Ramadan, moon suddenly, calculations is a bidah. Right, so we have to. I think we need to rethink that issue. I really think we should rethink the issue. Maybe we should now have a global Islamic calendar based on calculations. It makes sense because for everything else, from Salah to Iftar to Sehri, we're going with calculations. So why not throw moon sighting in there one time?
Second one, schools enforcing students to pray Salah, looking at high school students.
Mm-hmm. Is it right or wrong?
Because now, if they are unwilling to pray Salah, but they are forced to pray Salah, the intention is not there, what happens then?
The schools still have the right to do it because technically even the government could enforce Salah. The Salah would be valid. Meaning if someone is forced to pray Salah on time, their Salah will be valid. It will not count as the major sin of missing Salah. They just won't get the reward for the Salah. So there's still something there. There's still some benefit in that.
Okay. The other one, you ask for proof. That's how you're looking. You call the Salah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, so if you ask for proof, people call you a Salafi. Does that happen to everybody? That if you ask people for proof, they call you Salafi?
If somebody brings something to you,
yeah.
You say, where is your proof for this? Show me Quran, show me Sunnah, then okay, you're a Salafi.
Because apparently only Salafis follow Quran and Sunnah. That's a major problem. Okay, so technically all the mazhabs follow Quran and Sunnah. And so when it comes to an issue that isn't clearly from the mazhab, no matter what mazhab you follow, you have the right to ask for Quran and Sunnah. If someone calls you a Salafi, they call you a Salafi. That's their business. You don't worry what other people call you.
Okay, next one is sort of extension of that. Certainty versus doubt. Now we have, like you showed with smoking, legacy fatwas.
Yes.
Even looking at senior ulama, the of the mazhabs, can their fatwas be abrogated by maybe the latest students?
So when the question was that, we have fatwas from ulama 50 or 100 years ago saying something is halal or something is haram, and now we have new evidence on the issue. So can the fatwas change? The fatwas have to change. Because remember, we mentioned this in Usul al-Fiqh, Fiqh needs to be revised every 10 or 20 years. You can't stick to a fatwa made in India 200 years ago today. This actually popped up when the issue of smoking causing cancer came up. Ulama around the world had meetings on this. And they said, do we stick to the fatwa of our forefathers, that it's halal or makruh, or do we now change the fatwa, make it haram? So those who were strict on blindly following their forefathers, they stuck with the fatwa of it being makruh. Those who were more in favor of following the evidence, that's when they started saying, no, it's haram.
Another one, doctor was mentioning energy drinks.
Mm.
So that could very much be the same way as cigarettes.
We don't know yet.
We don't know yet.
Okay, so that's important. So things like energy drinks, even throwing the soft drinks like Coca-Cola and things like that, we don't know if they're harmful or not. We don't really have concrete evidence. Okay, doctors, maybe you can clarify this for us. Things like Monster Energy Drink, Red Bull, do we have yaqeen that they are harmful or shak? Like if someone drinks one more, okay, let me give you, honest with you, today I had to take a 5 kilometer walk and I bought an energy drink while walking back home, because I wouldn't have made it back home without it. So technically, are these things harmful? Okay.
And it also depends on quantities.
Quantities, right.
Your straightforward energy is a lot of sugar, caffeine, and flavoring, and all that sort of. See, again, we're going to go on the preservatives.
Okay.
All of them are loaded with a whole host of preservatives. Your Red Bull Monster are the same thing on steroids.
Okay.
A lot more caffeine. So again, if you fit and healthy and you have a bit of the extra dose, yes. If you are severe hypertensive, got an aneurysm in your head, and you start pumping down and preservatives, you're definitely causing harm to your body or potentially you can have a problem. And I know we have truck driver patients who take 2 and 3 Red Bulls because they're driving long distances.
Yeah.
And we see the effects in their blood patients.
Okay.
So quantity and other factors.
So what we can say then is that, again, it will come through most types of food, that people who are sensitive to it, we would tell for that individual it won't be allowed. But the issue now would be, in general, can you pass a general fatwa and say that energy drinks are haram because they are harmful? I would say at this point in time, no. They are halal until we have convincing evidence that they are harmful to everybody. Once you have evidence that they're harmful to everybody, so maybe in 10 years' time, half of us drop dead from energy drinks, then you can say, okay, harmful to everybody, let's make it haram. Until then, it's halal until proven haram.
Next one, you mentioned secret nikahs. What about saying, okay, I have a friend, instead of being in a long-term relationship, they were with intention to get married, where inevitably something is going to go wrong because they're meeting over time. What they chose to do, they chose to have the nikah a couple of years before the wedding as such. Those around them, no, they haven't hidden it, but they haven't had big publicized things.
Okay, it's a good point. So,
students.
I get what you're saying. So the I said that I'm against secret nikahs, and the example he gave is what if someone makes nikah and their family knows about it, but they haven't made it public yet. Maybe like in 3-4 years time they have a wedding and you know then it becomes public. It's in Islam, it's not considered secret if at least 5 people know about it.
Then,
yeah.
I'm actually the one who advised him to do that because he's not like
congratulations.
Inevitably something would have went wrong and neither of them wanted to go down that path.
Yeah.
And
no, as long as there are people who know about it. So for example, if one of them had to die, there's enough people that know about it to make sure that the inheritance and everything else is taken care of.
Both the immediate families and the close friends know.
It's not that, I mean, let's put it this way. There's not a single person in this room who ever see every single member of the Ummah knows that they're married. Right? Eventually, it's just some people know, some people don't know. Everyone. It's just that you need to make it as public as possible. But there's a minimum number. Minimum number is arbitrary. Some ones up say 5, some say 10. But it's like, as long as enough people know that if you die, they can sort it out. The main thing is it mustn't mess up things like lineage and stuff like that. And inheritance law.
Okay. And the next one is your public structure for your food addition. Zabiha, because that's the word I only heard when I heard the Americans were talking
about. Okay, so the Americans got this topic of Zabiha, right?
I don't know if you want to leave that.
Yeah, I'm also not too clear on that myself because I've heard 2 different definitions of what they mean by that, and I've got friends on every side of that. So I don't want to go into the issue. Doesn't concern South Africans, so I'll leave it out for now. Okay, let's ask someone else some questions as well.
On the issue of the Ahlul Kitab.
Right. Can we eat the meat of Ahlul Kitab?
Well, the food and the women, I'd like to know.
Okay. So the Quran states that the food of the people of the book is permissible for you, and the chaste woman are permissible for you. So there's two separate issues here. One is the food, one is the marriage, right? So I'll give you just, I'm not going to go into the long stories because the time's already almost up, but my position, when it comes to marriage, I believe that in a Muslim country, for a Muslim man to marry a pious, practicing Jew or Christian woman is permissible. It's not the best option. It's not the option I would encourage. I would say it's like makruh tanzihi, but it's permissible. And the marriage is valid and the marriage is acceptable. In a non-Muslim society, I would move in the opposite direction. Right? The reason being that, number enough reasons. Number one, the children. One of the main things we consider in Islam when getting married is the type of children that marriage is going to produce. So if the father is a Muslim and the mother is a Christian, they're growing up in a Christian country, children produced from that marriage, especially if there's a divorce, are more likely to grow up as Christians. And I personally know people like this in Durban. I know people whose father was Muslim, mother was Christian, they grew up as Christian. Right? So that's the big consideration. The other consideration is, the one in Umar ibn Khattab's time, he prohibited men from marrying women of Ahlul Kitab because they were choosing those women over the Muslim woman, and the Muslim woman weren't getting married. And nowadays that's the issue in our community. Muslim women are not getting married. So if there's so many unmarried Muslim women, why are people jumping for Jewish and Christian women? The third thing is, the Quran says muhsanat, the chaste Jewish and Christian woman. Most of the cases these days, when a guy brings his Christian girlfriend and says he wants to marry her, neither he's chaste nor is she chaste. Right? So there's very strict conditions there. I would leave it as something that I would not encourage at all in the society. Very rare circumstances I ever approve of it. But it's technically halal in an Islamic society, like makruh. Meat of the people of the book, again, same thing. The meat of a pious practicing Jew or Christian is halal. So I believe kosher meat is halal, because kosher meat is slaughtered on a very strict standard similar to halal meat. However, the issue of the mass market meat found in Christian and non-Muslim supermarkets in South Africa and USA and UK, the problem is the majority of Christians in these lands don't really follow Christianity. The majority of them are secular or humanist or atheist or cultural Christians. They aren't people who truly believe in and practice their religion. Yes, if you had to go to a Christian friend's house who is a practicing Christian, and he slaughters an animal in front of you, and he takes the name of Allah when slaughtering the animal, it will be halal to eat it. But the majority of meat in supermarkets is not like that. Right? So I would say, stick to meat. So in Africa, we have enough halal meat. We don't need to go to it. But like when you travel to America or to a country where there's no Muslims, stick to seafood or veg dishes, or if you have to eat meat, go to a kosher place. Right? A place that has kosher meat, that will be halal, inshallah. But otherwise, and the general mass market meat, I don't believe it's halal. Allah knows best.
There's more than a guest of Professor Fatih Osman, editor of the Arabian Magazine, many years ago.
Okay.
And he invited us to the restaurant, Tosses restaurant. And then he ordered chops and chips, and we ordered fish and chips. So then he sent $4 of fish and chips. And he says, you know what, by the way, it's Ahl Kitab. So I said, you know what, my mind actually really must come with cash.
And again, there are differences of opinion here. From my teachers, there are those who believe that like any McDonald's and stuff in America is halal because it's Ahl Kitab land. I do have teachers who hold that position. I also have teachers who live in America who don't follow that position, because they live there, they've met the Christians of that land, and they say these guys are not real Christians. So my teachers who actually live in America changed their point. They had that position originally, and then they moved to the other side and said, no, this meat is not halal. Because they're not slaughtering it in a proper way, they're not raising it in a proper way, but they're not real Christians, so it's doubtful, so stay away from it.
Long ago, in Buenos Aires, we asked the hotel, the receptionist was a Moroccan Muslim. We asked him where were halal places. And he said, the Mufti of Buenos Aires had said that because there was no halal butchers anywhere, and there was no halal meat readily available, that the red meat, other than the pork, anywhere it was permissible. Because if they didn't do that, the fear was that Muslims would go in and eat the pork and everything else as well. So to stop that, he had declared that whatever you ate, and if it was whatever red meat other than Aaron, was acceptable. So it was kullu halal.
I don't know if I would agree with that, but Allah knows best. Again, each alim knows their own country and what's the situation. We've never been in a situation like, so I don't know what fatwa we'd give if we were in a situation like that. The good thing is we live in South Africa. We literally have halal butcheries right through this entire road, this entire area, all competing with each other. So we don't really have to worry about that until we're traveling.
The issue was slavery. I mean, what's the difference between a captive?
Between?
Captive, war captive, and slave. I mean,
like today,
look at the same way or self-different.
Okay, so a war captive in Islam, when a Muslims capture someone in war, they have a choice on what to do with them. The choice being to free them, to ransom them, to kill them, or to make them slaves. So until they make that choice, they're not technically slaves yet. The captive. So, like, we look at the Battle of Badr, when they had the captives, they didn't consider them to be slaves. Those ones, they ransomed them, right? Certain other people they captured, they executed them, like the war criminals, like the leaders of the Quraysh. Certain one of them, they had the ruling that if these individuals, if you ever capture them, they would be beheaded because they're like the main causes or instigators of the problems. So, technically, it's only at that point when they decide, okay, now they are slaves. However, again, it doesn't apply to our times. Which of you got war captives? I'm saying it's okay, that's a good point. People like Boko Haram, those people are crazy.
ISIS.
Yeah.
ISIS have captured the Yazidi humans.
Yes.
And they regard them as haram.
I know they did that, but every single alim of every single madhab said what they did is haram. I don't know a single alim of any madhab who said what they did was halal there. Based on our fiqh, Muhammad al-Yaqubi has a good book on that, refuting ISIS. In his book, he has a whole section on the slave girl issue and what they did to the Yazidis is haram. He brings in the usul al-fiqh, the maqasid, everything there. He proves it to be haram. So if you can get hold of that book and read it, it's very clear. Technically, when slavery was removed from this world, Muslim and non-Muslim agreed that it's no longer acceptable. Right, and so Muslims now have a contract with the rest of the world not to take slaves. So therefore, it's not applicable to our times. The issue of reviving slavery as part of reviving Islam is not part of Islam, because technically our religion promotes freedom. Slavery was just a necessity of the times. When it comes to why slavery ended, there's two theories, right? The common one is that people suddenly realize that it's wrong. But that's not the truth. The truth is slavery ended because of the Industrial Revolution. Right? We no longer need someone standing here fanning us because we have ACs. Right? We no longer need people pulling our carts and, you know, 1,000 people building something because we have construction vehicles. The Industrial Revolution, machines replaced slaves. That's what happened. So, when that happened, that rolled out worldwide. There, and I honestly believe if the world had to go back to a time where there's no technology, it will again become a human necessity where those humans in power will start enslaving other humans. And even those people who are saying it's immoral will change their stance on it, because it's very easy to say it's immoral when we live in the only time in the history of humanity where it's not needed. But technically speaking, Islam does not consider slavery immoral. It's just something that should be avoided if it can be avoided, but it's technically halal. So in our times, it's avoided because it's not needed. There's social contracts in place. Our governments have signed contracts with other governments not to allow it. All of this is there. So it's something that we don't do, we don't think about, we don't talk about. But it is technically halal if the situation had to come up again. Nuclear war happens, technology gets obsolete. Thousands of prisoners of war are sitting there, don't know what to do with them. They would have a better life as slaves than sitting in jail, to be honest with you, in following the Islamic system. So Allah knows best.
You know, there's no time, and this is obviously the very controversial one about acts of worship.
Yes.
Obviously, the two obvious ones are salami, fazail amal after namaz, abidas, but communities are split, families are split. So that is maybe worth discussion, because not maybe now, but it comes up all the time.
Mm-hmm.
The entire salami, haram, halal, some would say, even, you know, if you have to read Sita Sadayama after Salah, that is a complete bidah. Where do we go with that?
Okay, so the issues of bidah in our community and the fierce debates over them, right? So on one side, we have salami, people calling that bidah. On the other hand, the ones doing salami calling 40-day jamaat bidah, and both sides calling each other's actions bidah. Really understand that this is an ijtihadi issue. This really is an ijtihadi issue. There are differences of opinion even amongst the qawaid as to what's the actual maxim here. So we have, for example, some ulama who do believe in a concept of bidah hasanah, good bidah. And we have other ulama who say there's no such thing as good bidah. So I don't think there's ever going to be consensus on this issue. At the most, we can have a sense of tolerance on this issue. That listen, there are two positions, you following those alims, I'm following these alims, let's just coexist. I mean, that's how the majority of Muslims live throughout our history. They just learn to coexist on these issues. These aren't even what I would consider the big bid'ah. I mean, when we talk about bid'ah in the classical books of Aqidah, what are they talking about? They're not talking about salami, or maulid, or tabligh jamaat, or anything like that. What are they talking about? They're talking about Qadianism, Khawarij, Shia. They're talking about groups with beliefs and practices that are far away from Islam in that sense, right? The differences that we have are differences within Ahl Sunnah wal Jama'ah. Those are ijtihadi issues. So, you're right, it is a topic that needs to be discussed. My problem with bringing it up is I don't think discussing is going to solve anything. Because there will always be these differences of opinion. The only thing we can do is maybe understand both sides and learn to understand where they're coming from and maybe create some sense of tolerance here. That, okay, these guys do salami, these guys don't. Let's put it this way. This group celebrates the birthday of the Prophet ﷺ out of love for the Prophet ﷺ. This group does not celebrate the birthday of the Prophet ﷺ out of obedience to the Prophet ﷺ. They're both doing what they think the Prophet ﷺ loves. I believe both groups will be rewarded for that. Right? Because they both have sincere intentions, they both have done their ijtihad, they both have arrived at a conclusion. They are classical ulama on both sides. When it comes to the birthday of the Prophet ﷺ, there are those like As-Suyuti, I think even An-Nawawi who said it's permissible. And there are those like Ibn Taymiyyah who say it's bid'ah. On both sides, great ulama. Right? What are you going to do with these issues? You just say, difference of opinion. So, yeah, it is a big issue, but I don't know how, if discussing it will solve anything except maybe creating some level of tolerance that these are acceptable differences of opinion. What's going to happen though is, if I say it's an acceptable difference of opinion, even now, tomorrow someone will send me a WhatsApp message proving it's not an acceptable difference of opinion and telling me that everybody on that side are kafir and I'm a kafir for saying it's an acceptable difference of opinion or whatever. So, I don't know how we solve this issue. I don't know. Our community are just, I think we're just too emotional about it. We get too emotional about these things and they really aren't big issues at all. I don't see them as big issues at all. I see these things Allah will forgive people for. You had sisters, any questions from your side? Okay.
This is a point on the issue of slavery.
Yeah.
And there was, a, I think, a good thing by Muhammad Ghazali who said it was a practice and in Islam, they went with it because if you didn't take their captive as slaves, it was like fighting a battle with one hand tied behind your back, because that was the norm at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened was, as in history progressed, the source of slavery became less and less.
Yes.
And Islam introduced, it was almost filling a bucket with more holes in it. So if you want to expiate for your sin free as slave,
yes,
a woman becomes pregnant, she's free, etc., etc. So you were allowing him to get out of slavery and closing the tap, feeding the slave as a market. So eventually, in time, there was going to be no slavery.
Yeah.
Like it was almost like an institution like alcohol. It couldn't have been abolished with one, one ruling, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
With time, as the...
The flaw with that argument is alcohol was abolished in the Prophet's lifetime, while slavery was only abolished 50 years ago in Saudi Arabia.
It was going to take longer than just...
Yeah. Okay, so the for me, the way I look at it is our slavery in our Sharia is similar to divorce. Does the Sharia encourage divorce? No. But it has an entire chapter on the fiqh of divorce. It's allowed, it's a necessity, it happens. Right? Slavery was the same throughout the bulk of human history. Allah wants people to be free. Allah encourages freedom. That's why He's put so many ways to free slaves and so much honor for the freedom of slaves. But throughout history, slavery was something that happens. So just like how there's fiqh of divorce, there's fiqh of slavery. Just like how there's permission for divorce, there was a permission for slavery. But even there, throughout history, Muslims do not consider slavery to be a good thing. Just something that's there as part of society. So you find many stories of the awliya, that someone will come to them and say that, there's too much slaves in our community. Give a Jummah lecture to tell people to free their slaves. So which means the concern of the people, even in that time when slavery was a norm, was that give people a lecture to free their slaves. Too many people are becoming slaves. So that's the Islamic mindset. It's allowed, it was allowed because, as a necessity, but it's not a part of the religion. Just like we won't say divorce is a part of the religion. So for example, if just magically tomorrow, Muslims stop divorcing each other, and everyone has happy marriages, will someone say we now need to revive divorce because it's in the Quran, and because it's part of the Sunnah, and because no one practicing the fiqh of divorce? No, we won't. Right? So same thing with slavery. Right? It's not practiced now, we forget about it, we leave it. And if we were living in that time, we probably would have practiced it. Right? It's just something which the Sharia has laid down laws for because it exists. So our time is up, and hope you all found this beneficial. Inshallah, next week we will cover two of the Qawaid al-Fiqhiyah. Jazakallah khairan wa akhir da'wana, and alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin.